This is Gabe Snyder, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. Now, I'm not in this episode, but you should still give it a listen. Enjoy!
I have to tell you, these have been some of the best weeks in terms of just getting to read all of our Genesis stories and getting to engage. And I can't imagine that there might be any problems anywhere. Not technological problems, not storytelling problems, not even maybe, say, getting your thoughts together problems. Well, no, clearly that's not true. I mean, hey, we're in the introduction section and I've already made some mistakes, but so have our biblical characters in this week's portion of Toldot. Now, we're going to do a lot of talking today about maybe what it is to kind of constructively enter into conflict or what it is to be able to navigate a difficult narration. Luckily for me, I have two experts in being able to lift up all of the voices in our stories and being able to recognize when those stories just aren't being told incredibly well. If you're ready for more story time and you're ready to maybe read a little deeper this week, come along with me. Let's get started. Some people have realized that we've been focusing a lot on stories for the last few weeks. We focused on a lot of stories with Vayera, and then we focused also on what helps us create our legacy generally when we are in Chayei Sarah. What happens, right? Who lives, who dies, who tells your story? And recently, we've been dealing a lot with stories tend to be written by the people in power, sometimes the people who were the winners. And that means that there are a lot of legacies and a lot of stories that get missed out on. And that's a challenge. But it's one that we might be up to facing this week with Toldot, especially with our two guests today that are going to help us manage and navigate maybe some of the problematic texts in Toldot, which is one of my favorite portions to talk about. April N. Baskin is the founding director of Joyous Justice. A driven and award-winning leader and coach, April mindfully brings her 20 years of experience guiding and leading the liberatory work of advancing belonging, shared power, and justice to all facets of her communal and public leadership. Recognized as a faith leader to watch by the Center for American Progress, she's a rising Kohenet, a Hebrew priestess, and is passionate about and committed to living a life of her boldest dreams and helping others do the same in the service of collective wellness and liberation. Tracy Guidecker, she, her, hers, is senior partner with Joyous Justice. She is also the co-host with April Baskin of the Joyous Justice podcast, formerly Jews Talk Racial Justice. Tracy completed her undergrad at Oberlin College and has an MA in Religious Studies from the Divinity School of the University of Chicago. She spent most of the last 25 years in the marketing, communications, or development departments of nonprofits, universities, and Jewish agencies. Tracy lives in Baltimore, Maryland with her Navy chief retired spouse, their elementary age daughter, an elderly dog, and a long-suffering cat, which I would argue, by the way, that if they were all in this tent, it would be like a very impressive, maybe Toldot style tent. Tracy and April, we're so excited to have you on the show. Welcome to Drinking and Droshing Torah with a Twist.
Thank you so much. It's such a joy to be here.
It's a joy to have you here. Tracy, it's also wonderful like to get to meet you for the first time face to face or face to Zoom or face to Riverside.
Right. Screen to screen, camera to screen, something like that.
That's when people are like, it's nice to e-meet you.
Right?
Those are always the comments. Yeah. Amazing. And of course, I'm so excited and so thankful, especially because my technological skills are always challenged, to have my favorite executive producer with us. What's going on, Edan? How's it going?
It's going great. It's good to be here on a Tuesday morning together.
Right? It's a new type of timing, and I'm actually so thrilled about that because we have an international show today. April's joining us from Senegal, which is super exciting and also makes us make sure that we have our recording at a time where everybody can feel kind of hopefully their freshest and maybe aren't getting up so early or staying up so late. I think that we're ready to get started with a little bit more storytelling and also a little bit of problem solving, because let's face it, Toldot isn't always the easiest portion to get your hands around. And so let's get started. As As a little sister, I have found that sometimes sibling squabbles are real, and there are always two sides of every story, but not every side gets told, especially when you are the younger sibling. Edan might be shaking his head right now as the older sibling. He's like, ugh, younger siblings get away with everything. But I'm here to argue that I think not all stories are told equally. However, I couldn't do this without Gabe and his incredible distilled partial summaries, which he has written. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here with us right now, but I'm going to do my best Gabe impression. We're going to see how it goes. And April and Tracy are going to get to react when it's done and add maybe their own spin to the story. So let's go. Toldot. Isaac was 40 when he married Rebecca, and he prayed to God because she wasn't having any kids, and God heard the prayer and said, okay. And Rebecca became pregnant with twins. The twins fought in Rebecca's womb, which sounds pretty uncomfortable. God says to her, two peoples are inside of you, two nations that will branch off from one another, and one will prevail over the other with the elders serving the younger. So she has the babies, Asa and Jacob, in that order. As the boys grew, Asa became a rugged outdoorsman, hunting and stuff, while Jacob was more of a homebody mama's boy. Isaac favored Asa because Isaac liked the meat Asa would bring home, but Rebecca favored Jacob. One day, Jacob was making a stew, or more literally, red stuff, and Asa wanted some, and Jacob said, I'll give you stew, but you have to give me your birthright. So he did. Doesn't seem like a fair trade to me, but whatever. Hey, look, another famine. I wonder if those will keep happening. But this time, our protagonists stay in the land because God says so. But they do settle in Gerar. When people ask Isaac about Rebecca, and he lies and says, she's my sister. The men in this family really need to stop doing that. Eventually, Isaac's lie is uncovered by Abimelech, but don't worry, it all works out. Meanwhile, Isaac is farming and God blesses him and the farming goes really well. Now Isaac is very wealthy with sheep and cattle and servants, but the Philistines are not too thrilled, so Abimelech tells Isaac it's time to leave. Outside of Gerar, Isaac digs some new wells. Cool. In Beersheba, God appears to Isaac and blesses him, so Isaac builds an altar and digs another well. This guy in wells. Abimelech is back, and he wants a treaty with Isaac. I guess he regrets telling him to get foe. Isaac accepts, and they eat and drink and make a vow. What's that? Another well? Cool. Oh, by the way, Isaac now has another wife named Judith. Rebecca doesn't love that. Isaac grows old, and his eyesight dims, and he calls Esau over and instructs him to go out and get some of that meat he likes, and then Isaac will bless him. But Rebecca was listening to this conversation and came up with a plan to put Esau's clothes on Jacob with maybe a little bit of animal fur and make the food Isaac likes and send Jacob in to get the blessing instead. Nothing will go wrong, right? Isaac is a little skeptical, but eventually relents and eats and drinks and blesses Jacob. Just then, Esau comes in, but Isaac had already given away the blessing. Guess you shouldn't have eaten that red stuff, Esau. So Esau is understandably pretty angry with Jacob, so Rebecca tells Jacob to run away and stay with Laban in Haran, and Esau goes off and marries Ishmael's daughter, Mahalat. And that's what you get with Parshat Toldot. That's a lot.
Woo! That was very well done.
Anything you feel like we're missing? Or I feel like, you know, Asa kind of gets a little bit sidestepped in this story.
Totally. Absolutely.
Yeah, even your point about who tells the story, like I was really struck by the way that it, at least in the English, it says, and that's how Asa spurned his birthright. Like, that's not what I read. I didn't read spurning.
I would agree. I mean, right, like, there again, when we talk about how stories are written and how we hear them, I've always loved some of the kind of flip stories. You know, the reason that Wicked is so popular is because it tells the story from the, quote, the Wicked Witch of the West's point of view, right? Because I think that, again, the people that tell our stories tend to be the people that are in power or, quote, unquote, the winners. They're not always winners in my book, but what are you going to do? And I think that that's probably something we're going to get into conversation about today, but it's definitely something we are wrestling, pun intended, within this particular portion. So this story is an interesting one, especially because right before this, and I find this like challenging, we often don't read the particular parshas together. And I gotta tell you that in Vayera, you know, we deal with Abraham showing how important hospitality is, right? Like he actually runs away from God to make sure that he welcomes the stranger. And you would think that Jacob, who is more of this tent man, like, right, like to be in the tent, like to cook food, would also have this hospitable nature, but I'm not seeing much hospitality coming from our boy Jacob, you know, this person who's supposed to be the person that we take after. And so I know, April and Tracy, a lot of what you have talked about is making sure that everyone's voices are really welcomed in the conversation. And I'm curious how that work got started and how kind of making sure that people do feel welcome, people are a part of the story, you know, inspires some of the work that you do today.
So first of all, I just got to say, one, you already was spoken about pretty well, but I really take issue with parts of this, Parsha, which you already spoke to beautifully, but I just need to clear the air a little bit, which speaks to why, you know, and it relates to exactly as you just set it up, why, you know, the overlapping nature of the work that we do in the world and the themes that this Parsha raises. There's so many things to be said. You know, I think in the context of wanting to advance justice in our world, and lately I've recently had this thought of like, justice is such a big, overwhelming concept. And so I've started to think like, you know, I think I want to frame it as just like collective well-being. Like what precedes justice, like safety, and what precedes safety is like well-being and people having their needs met in different ways. And what are the ways that this gets interrupted in our world regularly, right? And to your point, and as Tracy already highlighted about the power of story, stories and concepts so heavily impact how we view and frame things. And I think in this more subtle, specific realm, there's a lot of room for reimagining and reframing different thoughts that can lead us to take different, braver actions and tell narratives and stories that include more of us. And I think this gets tricky in a number of ways for people. And I'm doing that thing I do where I like talk in these big terms. And then Tracy has this metaphor that like, I'm the lighthouse and she's the flashlight. So she's going to come in a second with the flashlight mode. So just to be ready for that. Maybe I'll just stop there for now and let you chime in, Tracy. There's so many different layers of things that I want to say right now.
Yeah, Amanda's asked a big,
and it's hard for me to choose.
A big question, and it's also framed by this, as we noted, like super juicy Parsha and artwork.
Yeah,
is
yeah,
so big and juicy. And the question about sort of what got us started. Speak only for myself, but in the framing of Toldot, I think I had a moment of awakening where I realized I was Jacob, and I didn't mean to be, and I was totally crapping on Esau, and that was not my intention. And sort of realizing that my impact didn't match my intention was like a huge awakening for me. The fates, or April's ancestors, maybe, I don't know who brought me to April, but somehow, wonderfully, we found one another, and April was doing work to make sure that stories get told and that seats are, you know, places are set, even when folks don't know they want to be at the table yet, or sometimes actually going out, finding the table is already an act. And so we found one another and realized that we, you know, really complement each other in the metaphor that April just shared that I like to use, which I stole from a friend. Hi, Joval. And just in the ways that our similar and also divergent experiences in the Jewish community, because of our identities, leads us to be able to kind of understand and help others understand what is happening.
Thank you, Tracy. And I would follow that up quickly by saying we're in a period of growth within Joyous Justice, and a number of things are shifting. The way Tracy answered it in a more linear way, my more linear answer to that specific question that you asked us, Amanda, would be within a few years of me being brought into this world, my father was wrongfully accused and convicted of a crime he didn't commit. That deeply shaped my entire understanding of this world and what's possible, not just by those specific circumstances, but then the details around the story too, right? That my dad is this really gentle man who graduated at the top of his medical core class. And because of his background, thought it was useful and advantageous for him to go into the military, but didn't want to ever have to kill anyone, so opted to go into the medical core and excelled in that space, right? And that it's not the first time I've shared this, but just growing up, seeing someone to me who is a luminary around integrity and kindness and courage and resilience, and consistently that's still not being enough to protect him, right? what brings me to this work around joyous justice and the latest iteration and hopefully a long-term iteration of my life's work is that this is, for me, a part of my life's mission is being really passionate about whose stories are told and who gets harmed and misused in the quest often for superficial security and safety. And, you know, Tracy, you noted that you had this moment where you realized you were Jacob. And I think for me, as you were saying that, I just saw this image of like, almost like a yin yang symbol, but like swirling, like two swirling energies of, in my lived experience, I think in certain ways, the way I entered this world, there was a lot of Esau going on, but then through different parts of my living and with a deeply intersectional identity with many different aspects of disadvantage and oppression and immense privilege swirling in my experience, these are tensions that I really engage with deeply and that I try through our work at Joyous Justice to help other people to dive in deeply and to say the water's safe. We're going to be rigorous in our analysis, but we can also bring loads of compassion and understanding and support because ultimately at the end of the day, we're all just doing the best with the knowledge and understanding we have. And so how can we support each other and more joyously doing work in the service of collective wellness and liberation and bring great analysis and also really care for ourselves?
I think that I really love this idea that, you know, there are steps that kind of get to not only justice, but a joyous justice, right? Like something that people either can find joyful or enjoyable, you know, and those are two different things as well. But that there's this idea of reaching towards some sort of community peace, some sort of community ease to try to get to that next place. And I think it's really hard because siblings are not treated so amazingly in our Genesis story. They never are. There's always kind of one who is shaped more to be the villain, one who is shaped to be mistreated. Sometimes those flip in a sibling relationship. You know, I think Cain and Abel are a tricky story, but clearly I think Cain overreacted. You know, and one of the things that I appreciate, right, about a story that maybe Jacob and Esau could have learned from was this idea that Isaac and Ishmael, they come back together at the end when Abraham dies. There seems to be a meaningful moment that brings them back together. And here, the brothers are at it again. And I don't think there is this community input, community effort. I think that each of them are out for what's there for them. I have to tell you, I think it's so heartbreaking when Esau, whose story is also often so looked at as like, well, Esau was really the villain. And in this story, I don't think he is. But it's so heartbreaking when he's crying and you can imagine him with tears dripping down his face saying, like, Father, have you not one blessing for me? Do you not have anything for me? These things are tricky. And I'm curious about this kind of pie model that we kind of look at all the time, which is that if somebody has one slice, it takes away from someone else. And April, Tracy, I'd love to hear about your thoughts about moving away from this pie model into something else that might be A, more sustainable, but B, also just healthier for our society to kind of look at as we're trying to reach this joyful, enjoyable justice.
I love your attention and presence and that you're setting us up for layups around the things that we were planning on talking about. I love the alignment. It's really great and impressive. So yasher koach to you, Rabbi Amanda. Or Rabbi, future Rabbi Weiss. Tracy, why don't you answer this one first or respond to this one first? I'm sure. Grappling here with my neurospiciness a little bit.
You got it, April. Yeah, and thanks for the question, Amanda. I think that what you're pointing to is exactly what, as April and I were prepping and kind of talking about this parsha, some of what we were thinking about is that our patriarchs and matriarchs, because Rebecca's in it too, really seem to be driven by a scarcity model and by either or thinking that there's only one blessing, which just doesn't make sense to me. In the same way that parents don't have only enough love for one kid, surely blessings could be abundant. I mean, I feel like that is one of the messages that we get from our text is that blessings can be abundant. But the assumption, the either or assumption is so deep. it's not like I can point to one person and say, well, if Rebecca had changed her thinking, then things would have been different. Like, all of them are laboring under this same assumption that there's only enough for one. And I think ultimately that's the piece that if we could tweak that, the cascading effect would be, I think, huge. To your point, actually, Amanda.
And I think, you know, it's, to me, it's so fascinating, right? Because in this case, it's not actually a pie. It's literally a spiritual, conceptual thing. Like, there, it's not something that needs to be limited in any way. It is a blessing, right? It's not like there are only two stalks of grain or a bowl, or, you know, it's not something finite and fixed. This is in the realm of spirit and of energy and of consciousness and love. And so to me, as I was reading and thinking about this and revisiting this parsha that I have so many complex feelings about, and not just the parsha itself, actually, but the collective narrative that I see in our community about the framing and common interpretations around it. That, for me, is what's interesting and juicy, because there are heftier, more concerning portions of the Torah, but I feel like often the collective narrative also is more clearly like, ooh, this is problematic. And I find at times that, but I'm getting off track here, that there's a bit more of a pattern of covering up certain unseemly things because, oh, it's our patriarch. So we gotta make it okay, even if it's not okay. But this scarcity of consciousness, and, you know, what's coming to mind to me again and again here is the wisdom in the Torah of Viktor Frankl, of Dr. Viktor Frankl, right? That we always have the power of choice here. And for some reason, conceptually, that's just not within the conceptual frame of this narrative. And to me, I'm just struck by the profundity of actually how accessible it is. And the fact that it seems so inaccessible then makes me, or unaccessible makes me think then, what about this makes this more accessible?
I agree with this idea that A, life is meaningful and our stories have meaning in the way that we both tell them and hear them and are even, I would say, open to accepting them or changing them. And the messages that we take from these stories are really powerful. I think one of the things that gets to be difficult is people tend to kind of back away from confrontation or back away from conflict. And I think, April and Tracy, one of the things that you do so beautifully is actually enable people to still get the message, even if there is conflict or there is confrontation, that those moments of encounter can be so beautiful and meaningful if we're able to lean into it. And so a question I have for that is, how can people lean into kind of the conflict, the face-to-face, a little bit more willingly and strongly without shutting down, without kind of backing away?
Oh, yay. Thank you. That's such a juicy, amazing question. And Tracy and I have lots to say about this. You know, and first and foremost, rather simply but also profoundly and in a very practical, linear way, I would say, is to be prepared. And how can you be prepared for the unexpected, right? Is to get clearer in your analysis and the different tools and resources that you have to navigate moments where unexpected challenges arise, which is specifically where we help different leaders and professionals to build out these different tools and resources such that you cultivate different insights and reframes and perspectives within yourself, such that whenever you encounter a situation, you are able to navigate it and or you know how to pause and buy yourself more time, right? So in a very practical sense to me, that's the first way that I want to answer this question. And then the next piece I would say before I pass it over to Tracy to add additional layers and insight and perspective is, for me, what I find consistently, what's coming up intuitively, it's less intellectual, it's more intuitively, that is helpful in these moments is to continue to build our capacity to distinguish between inherent goodness and good intention, and something in the situation, either a behavior or a circumstance that needs addressing, that doesn't necessarily have to get to the level of that broader context or the person or the group being inherently bad, but there being something, but having a delineation between the inherent goodness of people and that there might be something that is worth discussing. In the work that we do across the board within Joyous Justice, people's inherent value and often even good intentions is never even in question. That's not the work we're doing. We know that's intact. We know that's there. The question is what societal programming, what adaptive or perhaps maladaptive survival strategies that people have earnestly and honestly developed, navigating life experiences through their own lives and through the process of navigating collective trauma and collective oppression, what are different habits that people formed that may be ancestrally proven best practices in some cases, but when it's applied regularly, consistently, or chronically, isn't helpful, right? And when we start to add that layer of analysis onto things, we can start situations that seem really messy start to get more clear. Like actually, a number of people I find still are really engaged in the question about intent. And to me, almost always, that actually is not really a big debate. I think nearly almost all the time, people have good intentions, but there's still something here that we need to dive deeper into and unpack, holding our inherent goodness always consistently and that never being in question. Tracy, I'd pass it over to you to add other layers and insight.
I think two specific framings that I think can help move in the direction of what April's describing, in addition to just being more aware of what everyone is bringing into the room. Two things. One is that my mom taught me when I was a kid that all fear is the same fear. Even the fear of death, all fear is the same fear. And the fear is that you can't handle it. And you can. And just remembering, like, you can handle this. You've done it before, right? Is an important...
With the right tools, yeah.
In terms of the specific question of backing away from conflict, I think that the fear that you can't handle it is one that we all have been forced to deal with conflict and we're still here.
Right.
So that's one. And the other is that coming back to our sort of either or thinking that we've been talking about a little bit, conflict or disagreement is not necessarily a sign that something's wrong, right? It's a sign that something needs to happen, but it actually could be that something is going right and people feel safe enough to approach you with it.
Yes.
So I think sort of reframing that like automatic, like, oh no, this means something bad is happening is an important component toward like a very specific mental reframe in the question of not backing away from conflict.
And I would just add on to that a little bit and say, yes, yes, yes. Thank you, Tracy, for covering that, because that was another piece that came to mind immediately when Amanda asked us this question. And I would just add more oomph to what Tracy said, is that these moments of friction are opportunities for growth, greater insight, for an expansion of the story, right? Going back to our broader theme around this Parsha and themes that have been coming up on your podcast of late, that when there are moments of friction, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity. And sometimes it truly is just a problem. But as Tracy said, I've often found in the work that when a number of my clients come to me about an actual or what they perceive as an actual problem or challenge, when I hear what's happening, I say to them, actually, no, I think you've actually made a ton of progress and created enough safety in your community that people feel comfortable raising the things that are bothering them to you. And that this is actually them reaching out from a place of trust and having a sense that for the first time in years that maybe something can be different. And because there's this backlog of hurt, it's coming out as upset, but it's actually deep trust and an opportunity for deeper connection and relationship.
I think absolutely. And I think that one of the things that is happening in the world around us is there's so much coming at everyone every day. I think that people are learning to become slightly more resilient, which I happen to know is something that's coming up for you soon, that you have a workshop that's coming up based in resilience, because I got an email today about it, your roadmap to resilience, which, by the way, we'll make sure to put in our show notes so that people have a link to be able to sign up for this December 5th event, which I think is going to be very, very cool.
Thanks.
My question for you, just because I know that we're a little short on time, is it is so difficult to kind of get that big, juicy, one sentence, you know, message out there to people when you're telling a story. And it seems, April and Tracy, that both of you do an incredible job kind of sending out dual messages that really strike home, you know, this ability to both handle fear and also to be able to use the tools to come at any particular situation that comes at you. And so my question for you before we move to our next section is, if you had one message, something that you wanted the listeners to know or feel or do after listening to this particular episode, what would that message be? And both of you get to either craft one separately or, as you've been doing so beautifully this episode, together. So I'm really excited to hear from you. What's the message that you would love for people to walk away with today?
Tracy, do you want to go first? Since we've been attempting to be anti-racist and having me answer the questions first as a Afro-Indigenous woman, and I know what I want to say, but I'm intuitively sensing that I think it would be good for you to share yours first and then for me to share mine.
Yeah. One takeaway is that I think the message that many of us have received, that we have to suffer in order to make the world a better place, is not true. And that at Joyous Justice, we can help you learn how to take care of yourself and the world. And yeah, sign up for the workshop, the Roadmap to Resilience, starting December 5th. You can sign up for that now.
Yay. All right. And so here's what I would say. I partially have some notes, and then I'm also just kind of going off the cuff here, right? Is that my one line, which might be a run-on, would be that as people who care about justice and wellness in our world, it is possible for us to powerfully advance toward this, and that our well-being is not separate from that, that those things are interconnected, that we are fundamentally interconnected. And if we want to advance a world in which there is thriving for all of us, we start at the ground fractal level of also bringing thriving and wellness into our own lives and stop seeing them as disparate and instead see them as complementary dynamics that feed on each other and support one another. The better we care for ourselves, the better we are equipped to care for our world. And so, yes, I'm really excited. Thank you for lifting up our upcoming event, Amanda and Tracy. We have this amazing 4-day live workshop that we are doing. And if you can't catch it live, then you can sign up to receive the recordings. And it is a really robust, quick overview of some essential reframes that can make all the difference in helping you bring more ease into navigating the difficulties of life that show up in work, in our personal sphere. And I've been doing an extensive amount of work around a number of overlapping themes and issues, and have come to realize a number of these challenges, they seem siloed and separate, but a number of the core principles that are deeply true and get close to the capital T truth around some of these things actually are deeply aligned. And we don't have to feel so disparate and scattered, and we can have a core set of tools that help us navigate many different situations.
I really have to raise my glass to my regular co-host, Gabe, who, again, unfortunately couldn't be here for this episode, but did do the writing, because what a buddy. You know, I laugh because I have an older brother, Adam. As I mentioned, I'm the younger child in my family. But I also like to think that I have a younger brother in Gabe. And oh boy, is it good that I do, because he happened to name this drink the Brother's Quarrel. We'll start with 2 thinly sliced 1-inch rounds of ginger for our 2 brothers, just to be sure to peel the ginger before slicing. Use a spoon, like I imagine Esau did with the soup, for easier peeling. That's a funny joke, Gabe. A+. Muddle those up in the bottom of a shaker and add in 2 ounces of a blended scotch. A blended scotch has less of the smoky flavor and more of a sweet bourbon smoothness. Add to that 1 ounce each of honey and fresh squeezed lemon for our sweet and sour family dynamic, and shake with ice. Strain into a lowball glass with 1 large ice cube. Remember, there's only 1 blessing to go around, although Tracy and I disagree. And carefully top with 1/2 ounce of a single malt scotch. Single malt has those earthy, smoky tones for all of the hazy trickery and anger at the end of this portion. For a non-alcoholic version, we're going to replace the blended scotch with 2 ounces of apple juice, which will contrast nicely with a half ounce of apple cider for the single malt. Either way, express the oils of a lemon peel by pinching over the top of the glass and float it on top for garnish. We hope this drink, complex but comforting, hits the spot. Just don't treat it for your birth rate. And as always, l'chaim.
Woo!
Nice job, Gabe. A plus. April and Tracy, any reactions to the brothers' quarrel?
It sounds delicious. The ginger, I think, would give it an interesting kick.
As someone who's living in a dry country right now, I'm curious what the dry version of that is that my partner, Asan, my twin partner, Asan.
That's the one with the apple juice and apple cider.
Oh, I missed that.
In place of the scotch.
I missed that. Okay. Ooh. Yeah. Asan's not liking that, but I would love that. I'm all about that apple cider vinegar life.
I
would have 2 servings of that for the both of us while we are in Dakar. And if I was just alone with y'all and we were just in a Jewish space, I would absolutely be enjoying the nice saucy alcohol with the ginger with y'all. Yes, here for it.
I will say also, like, I also like apple juice and apple cider, so I could be happy on either, and I think it could go well. But we do have a little bit left to go, so I want to make sure we hit our thank yous and closing cues, which is coming up right now. Speaking of kind of a bittersweet, complex, but comforting moment, I can't believe we're here already because it seems like the time has flown, but we're actually at our closing section, our thank yous and closing cues. And so April and Tracy and even Idan, in Toldot, we find our characters' narratives defined from the very beginning. Esau is the mighty hunter and Jacob is the timid huntsman and Rebecca is a cunning housewife and Isaac plays, well, you got it, the dim-witted dad. There are dangers to judging people at first glance. How might we use Toldot as a reminder to look beyond our first impression? April, I'd be thrilled if we could start with you.
So I think this is a really juicy question. For me, what comes to mind is presence, right? That to me, what was missing throughout the story in a number of different ways is there are things that are being said, but how are we being present with the two boys and then young men who are in front of us now? How are we being present and engaging the divine presence within ourselves, right? That sacred divine flame of that to me is infinite, a piece of infinite love and infinite possibility, and that wisdom that we learn from Dr. Viktor Frankl around always having the power of choice and being in dynamic tension as someone who at times really appreciates some of these sources of wisdom that tell us at times certain things that are going to happen. It's not completely dismissing it, but not just going into autopilot through our lives. And if something doesn't feel true to us or about the people around us, interrogating it.
Thank you, April. This idea of presence, but also not even a passive presence, kind of like a real active presence is meaningful.
Yes, thank you. Exactly.
Tracy, what about you?
I think that the idea of the active presence that April just articulated is really resonating for me in our Parsha. I'm thinking specifically of the moment when Jacob, with the goat skin on his hands, is talking to their father. And like, if Isaac had been able to be more present and actually not, I mean, to your point about taking people at face value, like he touches the furry hand, but it's Jacob's voice. So, you know, I think there's something in maybe some instruction leaning into that presence and that intuition. I mean, something told Isaac that though we've been given him as a dim-witted dad, like even in the text, we see he had an inkling that something was off. And perhaps if he had trusted that a little more, the story would have unfolded differently.
I was just saying that this is something that I spoke to in my senior sermon last year about the idea that these characters aren't necessarily defined by the way that we're first introduced to them. And that if we are able to maybe flip those points and be able to see them for a little bit deeper, there's the possibility to become even stronger in relationship with them, which I think matters. And I think it's tricky Idan, I know that you always like to go as a last kind of answer, and I usually end you after this. But Idan, what are you thinking in terms of beating out first impressions?
I think a lot's been said already. That's really touches on that, and I wanted to kind of approach what a different part of the question you mentioned. This Parsha really boxes in Isaac and Esau in a very certain way. By judging someone in a certain way, we're really boxing them into something that either they might not want to be, or that they aren't, or it might also affect how they see themselves and affect their trajectory, in life. And it kind of can affect and cut off sort of like ways that they can see themselves and really push themselves into the future, and how they will grow and stuff. And it really could affect that. And so really trying to not box people in that way is, I think, really, really important.
May I squeeze something in response?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
Oh, you're so perceptive, Amanda. And I wanted to add, but I was inspired by something that you just shared, Amanda, and then Idan added on to it even more, that I'm reminded of Midrash Tanchuma, right? Like of the passage in which it says, and I'm going to do a slight variation of it, right? That a modernized version of it that I've learned through Jewish LGBTQ spaces, right? That there are three names that each of us are given. The name that people gave us, the name that people call us later on, and the name that we choose for ourselves. And the most important name is the one that we choose for ourselves. And I think that's, I'm paraphrasing, I might not be getting it exactly right, but the Midrash is something along those lines, right? And the idea here, to me, that just accentuates what we all just said, right? That there are multiple layers here, right? And we don't want to disavow any one of them, but we also don't want any one of them, the what's being dictated versus what's being experienced versus what we feel internally with divine presence, right? That like we need to weave those different pieces and also notice that there is a bit of truth about what we know about ourselves, and that needs to be in dialogue with that broader framing, and not just let it be this external, oppressive, one-dimensional story, right? That we get to be actively be a part of our own stories and how we identify and name ourselves and the truth of our existence.
Absolutely. And I think that these are major pieces of conversation that people are looking to, or people are trying to understand. And so April, Tracy, if people want to learn more, if they want to be in contact with you, we'll make sure to put the training that's going to come up in our show notes, but how can people best find or follow you?
Some of the best ways to do that, we are on most social media channels. You can visit joyousjustice.com. On Facebook, we have a Facebook group, the Joyous Justice Community, that's free and people are welcome to join. We're going to soon be hosting lives there and doing a number of different things in the space. The event that we're doing later in December is going to be hosted there. Tracy, anything else you want to add? Oh, and our podcast too. We also have a podcast. Maybe we can have y'all on our podcast sometime, because we're going to hopefully be accepting guests soon. So that would be fun to do. Anything else, Tracy, that I missed?
I think you got it all, April.
I love it. I love this partnership. It's been such a pleasure to be in conversation with you. Thank you both so much for making the time for us today. In spite of all of my technical difficulties, you've been absolutely delightful. Thank you, of course, to Gabe for writing everything down for me so that I was able to kind of step in and just knock it out of the park. You did great. Thank you so much to Idan for your also eternal patience with my ridiculous technology. For those that might be able to hear, we're recording this at school. It's been a little bit nuts today, but we've been making it through. And thank you, of course, to all of our listeners for making this show what it is. We couldn't do this without you. And it's so exciting to be able to have yet another group of folks that just love uplifting other people's stories and making sure that everybody gets their voices heard. Our conclusion is going to be coming up to you soon, so stay tuned. I really appreciated the insight that April and Tracy brought to today's conversation, especially considering the fact that Toldo is a pretty love story. I mean, people like it because there's clearly a good guy and a bad guy, except wait a minute, no, there aren't. The story is really complex and complicated, and just like Gabe's drink, sometimes comforting, but also sometimes questioning. I mean, it's a little difficult to be able to really engage with the story when you realize that not everybody's getting treated fairly, both inside the story and after the story is done. We talked a little bit about this, the fact that Aesaw kind of gets a bad rap in this story, especially because it says Aesaw spurned his birthright, when Jacob really kind of just talked him out of it. I mean, should Aesaw really have lost his birthright for relying on Maslow's hierarchy of needs? I wouldn't think so. By the way, for people that don't know Maslow's hierarchy, this is this idea that before we can get to the top of self-actualization, that we need to take care of things like food, safety, our physical requirements, making sure that we're really okay and ready to go. On the other hand, don't we do this all the time as people? Sometimes forget that we don't always get who people are after our first meeting with them or our first impression. A lot of the times, I think that many of us are guilty of playing to Isaac or playing to Aesaw or playing to Rebecca, of kind of having these moments of first impressions where people just don't always come off the way we expected them to. And then sometimes we judge them unfairly and even unexpectedly. Here's what I'm saying. Even if we go in assuming goodwill and we assume that everyone has the best of intentions, as April and Tracy talked about doing, it's really important to remember that the impact is what matters of our actions and our words, that it's the impact of the stories that we tell ourselves and that we share, and it's the impact of the actions and the decisions that we make every day that really intentionally change the world that we live in today. And so I invite you this week specifically to think about, what stories are you telling yourself? What intentions do you have? What impact do you have? And how might those change just by taking a step back and being willing to have an active presence and maybe even an active imagination about how we could work together to create a community sense of ease that would then maybe lead to a joyous, joyful, enjoyable justice for everyone to partake in? It could be pretty powerful if you just give it half a chance. I hope that all of you are willing to step up to the challenge. Maybe sign up for that December 5th workshop that you can find in our show notes. And of course, be willing to raise your glass to people who are really doing the anti-racism efforts and also working to uplift the stories of all peoples, not just the ones that we are most familiar with. So we raise our glass to you this week and every week, saying L'chaim to all a good life.
I'm Gabe Snyder, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. Fun fact, Debbie Friedman wrote, "Happy Thanksgiving! Hooray, hooray, hooray! Aren't you glad you're not a turkey on this Thanksgiving day? Happy Thanksgiving! Hooray, hooray, hooray! Aren't you glad you're not a turkey on this Thanksgiving day?" Happy Thanksgiving from your friends at Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist.